Salutations, sports nerds. It's time for another episode of War on Hot Takes, presented by Capital News Service. I'm Dylan Sin, and with me as always is Adam Zalanka. Please check us out on Twitter if you haven't yet, at War on Hot Takes, plus on SoundCloud and at cnsmaryland.org.
Dylan is here to gloat about his Chicago Cubs, who are currently in a tough battle with the Dodgers in the NLCS, but who topped your Washington Nationals in Game 5 last week. We're going to perform a post-mortem report for the Nats the way we did for the Baltimore Orioles a few weeks ago. We'll also catch up on the NFL, as always, and then it's time to get excited for basketball again. The Wizards kicked off their regular season Wednesday night. But before we have room for basketball on this podcast, Dylan, let's give the local baseball team its proper goodbye. You know that's where we have to start. Game 5 against the Cubs has been so long ago since the last time we talked here in the booth, and now the Cubs are facing a bigger struggle against the Los Angeles Dodgers, Dylan, but...
Yeah, it's been tough for the Cubs over the last week or so. The Dodgers have really been a much better team, and it's taken a lot of the shine off that Game 5 win over Washington, although that was still a lot of fun to watch.
I'm sure it was for you, Dylan.
Maybe not for some of our listeners. Maybe not understand that.
Maybe not for any of our listeners who are probably going to be looking at you as a villain from now on. I'm not saying stop listening to the podcast, but there's good and evil in this booth.
You know, that is a mantle I am willing to hold. Someone has to be the villain, and might as well be me.
Well... We, a few weeks ago, had the Baltimore Orioles, their season ended, and we had a post-mortem report for them, sort of autopsy on their season and where they go from there. And I think it's time we do that with the Washington Nationals. That's how we'll lead off the podcast today. So, Dylan, it took 5 games for the Cubs to squeak it out. Washington's a very, very good team all around, honestly. You've got Bryce Harper, you've got a great pitching rotation, you've got a great infield, really, is locked in. What do you think the Nationals need to focus on in the offseason?
Well, I think you hit on it already, and the biggest thing they need to focus on this offseason is Bryce Harper. Harper is under team control through the end of 2017. He's owed $21.6 million this season. But after that, he is a free agent. So the Nationals, probably their biggest offseason priority for this year, is to get Bryce Harper signed to a long-term deal. Now, whether he wants to sign a long-term deal in the offseason or not, whether he wants to end up testing free agency is something that's really up in the air right now. Scott Boras, his agent, their clients normally end up testing free agency. But Steven Strasburg signed a deal that took away his free agency years. The Nationals gave him an extension. So we'll see if Harper is willing to sign a similar extension for big money and maybe give away some of his free agent years for some stability. The biggest issue is, according to SpotTrack, which now has a new market value system, that's a website that keeps track of players' salaries, and Bryce Harper's market value, according to the website, is about $26 million a year compared to some other players around his age who have signed free agents extensions over the last few years. Now, the biggest issue with that is that that's not what Harper is going to sign for. He is going to sign to become the highest paid player in baseball history, and it's because people still like to dream on Harper's potential. People remember 2015 when Harper was just an absolute god at the plate. He hit 42 home runs, 330, 460 on base percentage, slugging percentage up near 650. He was worth over 9 WAR. It was the best non-Mike Trout season of any player since 2010.
The best season anyone's had, except for Mike Trout, in the entire league.
In the entire league since 2010. And so that is the potential. People want to believe that Harper can hit that every season. It's probably not realistic to expect that, but even a shadow of that is still likely to make him end up being the highest paid player in baseball history when he signs his free agent contract.
So that's going to cost the Nationals a lot of money, and you're saying they already have to start thinking ahead for that because there are going to be other teams in competition for him if he does test free agency.
Exactly, and it's going to be something that the Nationals have, quote-unquote, the home field advantage for right now. But as the season goes on and he realizes I'm just going to hit free agency next winter, the Nationals will be just like any other team. They're going to be bidding for his services. This year they can play the, you came up with us, you've been successful with us, and they'll try to play that card.
Well, that's one corner of the outfield. And when you look at the other corner where Jason Worth has lived for 7 years now, his 7-year contract that started in 2011?
Yes.
started in 2011, is up now. And so he's also a pressing need in free agency to replace, because I doubt they're going to bring him back after last season.
No, absolutely not. And it really is the end of an era in Washington. He, as you said, he has been there for 7 years. They signed him to a 7-year, $126 million deal back in 2011. And it has really been an up-and-down era for the Nationals in left field with Worth. He had a couple of good years where he was worth 4 or 5 wins, and a couple of years where he drove Nationals fans crazy, especially this year. He was sub-replacement level.
His WAR of negative 0.7.
Exactly, according to Baseball
Just
Reference.
Just under zero.
He hit .226. He only played 70 games because of injury, and that was a common theme for Jason Worth throughout his career with the Nationals. He only averaged 103 games per season, so injuries were a big part of the storyline, and when his legacy in Washington is written, that'll probably be up there in the first paragraph. But, you know, he hit over 100 home runs with the Nationals. He had .355 on base percentage. He was worth 13 WAR overall throughout his 7 years with the team. And he became something of a fan favorite over the years. His beard and his long hair were always noticeable out there in the outfield, and it really is the end of an era in Washington.
And with that era now ending, Dylan, what do you suggest they do? Do they have somebody on the major league roster who can step in? You've got Michael A. Taylor in center. That's sort of their next best young outfielder. Or do they bring somebody up from the minors? Or do they try to make a run at a free agent?
And that's the thing, is it's really unclear right now. And the biggest X factor in that discussion is their young prospect, Victor Robles. Now, Victor Robles played center field in the minor leagues. So if they brought him up, it would probably move Michael Taylor, as you mentioned, over to left field, and Robles would play center because he is one of the best defensive center fielders in the minor leagues right now. But the issue is that Robles is only 20 years old. He came up to the major league roster at the end of this season for a small cup of coffee. He had about 25 plate appearances, but he has never played AAA baseball. They brought him up immediately from AA in September just to get him a taste of the major leagues. So it's completely unclear whether they want him to have one more year of development in the minors or they're ready to make him their everyday center fielder next year. He's torn up Double A and Single A over the last 2 years. He's ranked as the number 9 prospect in all of baseball, top prospect in the Nationals system. So it's entirely possible they decide they're going to hand him the keys to the center field job right away, but who knows? He's only 20 years old. Another year of seasoning could be a possibility for him too.
Other players in this roster are like Brian Goodwin. I will make the case for Alejandro de Haza, who I just found out has put on 7 different uniforms since opening day of 2014. So 4 years. He wore an Oakland Athletics uniform in the most recent spring training, but didn't end up going to bat for him. But he appeared in 28 games for the Nats this year in his first and only season with Washington this year. And I don't know, he's 33 years old. I just thought, wow, talk about journeyman.
It's definitely a possibility.
Maybe Robles is a better one.
Could be a stopgap until Robles is ready. Pull what Chris Bryant did with the Cubs, hold Robles down in AAA for 15 games and then bring him up in mid-April when you realize he's way too good for the minor leagues. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where the Nationals go with a spot that was, you could pencil in Worth at the beginning of each season, and now that's not the case anymore.
So just to emphasize one more time, you're saying if they were to have Robles start on the major league roster next year, he would be the center fielder and Michael A. Taylor would shift to left?
More than likely. Robles, one of the best tools that he has is his defensive ability. By some statistics, he was worth as many as 15 runs above average in minor leagues in center field this year. That's according to Clay Davenport. So he is a great defensive center fielder, and that much at least he should be able to contribute right away.
Well, that's about all we can say about this team as far as what could be improved or what needs to be locked in the case of Bryce Harper. Your outfield needs to be settled in, but your infield, your pitching rotation, your bullpen, for the most part, when we were talking before the episode, you said, you know, bullpen for any team is a year-by-year proposition, trying to settle that in. But it's a good team, and this team, unfortunately, like every Washington pro sports team in the major four leagues, has been unable to make it to the conference finals, or league finals in the case of baseball, the NLCS, because of this curse. In case you haven't heard, in case you've been living under a rock since 1998, it's been 69 seasons since any Washington team in the four major leagues has made it to the step before the championship, whether that's your league championship series in Washington baseball, since they appeared in the middle of the last decade, or if it's the conference final series in basketball or in hockey, or in the case of the NFL team, making it to the NFC championship game. The Caps were the last team to do it. Is that right? In 98?
1998. They made the Stanley Cup Finals and lost, and no one's been back since.
But when you string together each baseball season, basketball season, hockey, and football, with baseball having fewer opportunities since the Nationals came here from Montreal, it's 69 in a row now.
Not only that, they've had 13 chances between the four teams. 13 games where all you need is a win.
Win and you're in.
And win and you're in. And they've lost all 13 of them. That is an incredible record for futility. I mean, there's a lot of sports cities across the country that you could point to. Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, all these cities feel like they're cursed in some way. Washington is right up there with any of them in terms of the misery index.
Washington's is unique. I like that. Misery index. Washington's situation is unique. It's not that, oh, we haven't had a championship in 100 years because, you know, the NFL team won some Super Bowls in the early 90s. But look, first of all, if everything we just said in the last minute is not any news to our audience, man, because right. They've lived it. We're the outsiders, always looking in. And we are not the suffering ones. We've suffered in our own ways. You know? You're listening to a Jets fan and a Cubs fan, so we've paid our dues. I'm still paying. We're not some Bostonians coming in and saying, like, ha, ha, ha. Firstly, I want to just recommend anybody who is sick of this to just focus a little more on the Mystics and DC United, because they are excluded from this talk whenever we talk about it or anybody talks about it. I don't mean to get up on some sort of high horse and shame whoever, or not remembering soccer and women's sports, but the Mystics were just in the conference finals, and that's great, and they got that far, and they're a very good basketball team. And DC United has won the MLS Cup. So it was in the middle of the 2000s beating Kansas City, and those sports don't have the same audience that the Caps, the NFL team, the Wizards, or the Nationals do. It's the four major sports for a reason. So I come down firmly on the middle. My recommendation, if you really can't stand it, is go to soccer games or go to WNBA games and watch a very good basketball team. Or if you don't want to, that's your right too. If you just really desperately want to see the Capitals in the Stanley Cup, of course you do. That's your right. And that's the city's right to get something to go right for them in the sports world, Dylan.
All I'm saying is that if you're fed up with this, which I think a lot of Washington fans are, is you have options to go other places.
You could also move.
You could also move. That is definitely a possibility. Move because your sports teams are bad.
That's the one reason. You know, millennials, we move around job to job at our young age. Listen, let's wrap up the segment on this, Dylan, because we're away from baseball now, just looking at DC sports in general. We really haven't addressed this until today, since we began the podcast. Dylan, between the four major teams that are included in this curse, out of them, which do you think has the best chance of breaking it?
It's an interesting one for me because I believe that it's the Nationals. And the reason that it's interesting is because the Nationals really only have one more chance. If Harper leaves after the 2017 season, then there goes the Nationals window. But I feel like that actually helps them because it'll make them go all in for next season. They'll make the moves to the trading deadline they need to make, and it'll kind of light a fire under the team. And I really think that next year is the year they go for it and the year they break that curse.
My first thought is, wow, Dylan picks the baseball team. What a surprise. And my second thought is you started to make the case against your own pick by saying they have one more shot at this. And if it doesn't work out next year, and you know how crazy and sometimes unpredictable playoff baseball is. Look at the Yankees right
sometimes.
Now.
Sometimes.
All the time. Look at the Yankees right now, for example. So I'm going to completely disagree. I think it's going to be the Washington Wizards. I've got a couple reasons why. First of all, let's exclude the NFL team based in Landover, Maryland, because they're the furthest away. These are four good teams, but even with their record being what it is, I think the NFL team right now is fourth out of four on my list.
I would agree with that, too.
We'll talk a little bit more about them later in the show, but as for this conversation, not them. And for the very reasons Dylan just gave, I'm out on the Nats because of the crapshoot that is playoff baseball and the small window that they have. Between the Wizards and the Capitals, I'm going for the Wizards for a few reasons. We're recording this just essentially hours after Gordon Hayward dislocated his ankle in a gruesome kind of way. And the Boston Celtics suddenly, who are these Boston Celtics in the East? They don't have Hayward, which was supposed to be half of their identity this year.
Right.
And they don't have Isaiah Thomas.
Kyrie Irving and Al Horford and then a bunch of young kids.
I think this team's a little overrated if Hayward is hurt.
Right.
Personally. I think their stock goes way down.
I agree with you. That he was at worst their second best player and possibly on some nights he would have been their best. So it's definitely...
Kyrie wanted to be the man. Here's your chance,
right,
Kyrie.
Exactly.
You're now the man.
He's going to have to drag this team as long as Hayward's out.
With Boston being hampered that way this year, and with the rest of the Eastern Conference outside of the Cleveland Cavaliers being a little bit weaker. Toronto is nowhere near the competitor they were four seasons ago. Chicago Bulls are horrendous, Dylan. The Nets are
bad. You
couldn't
resist that, could you?
No, of course not. But my old Nets, they're bad. The Sixers are looking a little better. The Bucks are young and interesting and exciting. But that's essentially it. The Wizards really could be, if not the two seed, they're the third best team in this conference when the Boston Celtics are healthy. And my other reason for not picking the Capitals, though, is the playoff structure. We saw last year that because the NHL changed their playoff structure to try and make sure they had more eyes early rounds, Stanley Cup playoffs, the Capitals were forced to play the Pittsburgh Penguins in the second round when that really should have been the conference final matchup. Those were the two best teams in the East, bar none. So because of that, that hampers the Capitals that they don't get to play the weakest opponents early in the Stanley Cup playoffs. But because of that, I think the Wizards have the better shot because they can come in and have a good 52-54 win season this year, be one of the best teams in the East. They wouldn't have a shot if they were in the West, by the way. They would not advance past all those great teams.
Not at all.
Let's be clear. But in terms of making a conference finals, all they got to do is beat Philly or Milwaukee in the early rounds and advance, and who knows how they'll match up against Cleveland at the end, but we know that's sort of where it would be. I think they're better than Boston, and that's what I'm going with to answer my own question, the Wizards. And we're going to talk about them later in the show too, Dylan.
John Wall in the Eastern Conference Finals, here we come.
We need that. We're not even Wizards fans, and we know we need that. Everybody in the NBA, all basketball Twitter, what's it? Hashtag NBA Twitter has its own icon this season. NBA Twitter needs that. We all want to see that. But let's wrap this up. It's going so long, and we got a lot still to talk about. NFL's coming up. Wizards have just tipped off their season. We're going to talk about their first game of the year coming up.
Hello and welcome back to War on Hot Takes. Now we're going to get into some NFL talk. We're going to start with the team from Washington, which is coming up on a huge Monday night game against the division rival Philadelphia Eagles. That will be the second time the Eagles and Washington have played against each other this season. The Eagles won the first matchup, one of Washington's two losses this season. Washington now sits at 3-2 after having beaten the 49ers this week.
And not only that one of their losses was against Philadelphia, their other loss was to Kansas City, which until recently was undefeated and now are 5-1 with their loss to Pittsburgh last week. So Washington's only two losses came against teams with the two best records, or the best record in the NFL, Dylan.
Right, and so after this week, if Washington somehow loses again to the Eagles, they would end up being 3-3 with all three of their losses coming to probably the two best teams in football at this point. It's fair to ask, are they a good team? Are they a mediocre team? Their schedule has been brutal so far, but then again, they barely this week beat the 49ers. C.J. Beathard ran all over them in the second half. So it's tough to say where Washington stands at this point.
That's tough to say, you're right, because C.J. Beathard is not a good quarterback. Not supposed to be, anyway. He came in and sure looked better than Brian Hoyer did for the 49ers on Sunday. I watched some of this game, and as shaky as that defense looks, the offense looked pretty good, especially that Chris Thompson play. It was a screen pass that he just juked a guy and just sprinted downfield, and a couple of key blocks helped him there. I should have checked this. I think it went 60 yards.
Yeah, it was in that area, and it's just another example of the fact that screen passes to Chris Thompson have been one of the most lethal plays, not only for Washington this year, but all across football, and I found these stats right here to be pretty incredible. Thompson leads the league in yards per catch at 18.28 and yards after the catch at 329. Thompson is a running back. It's important to say that because he hasn't had a statistical line like a running back this year. He is racking up receiving yards, and that yards after catch, which stands at 329, as I said, that's after playing in only five games when some wide receivers have played six. So he really has stood out among not only running backs, but among all pass catchers in football this year. And those screen plays, until someone proves they can stop it, I would assume Washington is just going to keep running it at everybody.
329 total yards after catch is right. What you're saying, right, Dylan?
Yeah, so after he catches the ball, that's when that starts, and then every yard he runs after that accrues.
Do you know how many total yards he has receiving this year?
I do not.
340. Which means that 97% of his yards have come after the catch, which, as you're talking about, it's the screen plays. It's right. Catching it. That ball's barely traveling through the air. It's essentially an extended dump off his way. He's got far more receiving yards than he does rushing yards, and it's all him. It's not like Kirk Cousins heaving it downfield to Chris Thompson.
The Eagles' defense is kind of a tale of two units because they have one of the best run defenses in all of football. Actually, the number one running defense in all football. But their passing defense is actually one of the five worst. And you saw that last week. They're particularly vulnerable to passes out of the backfield. They gave up against the Panthers. Christian McCaffrey caught 10 passes out of the backfield for 56 yards.
Yeah.
So Thompson is exactly the type of weapon that the Eagles struggle against. And so it'll be interesting to see how they game plan for him this week.
It could be the case of Chris Thompson just has the same kind of game as Christian McCaffrey does. Or it could be the case that the Eagles, since they had a week and a half to prepare for this because they played Thursday night last week and they'll be playing Monday night this week, that they'll spend extra time correcting for Chris Thompson. Either way, I think it's going to be up to Kirk Cousins and the weapons around him on the offense to pass their way through, because their running game continues to be subpar. And like you said, the Eagles are going to stuff them up in the middle anyway.
And one of those weapons, as you were talking about, the biggest weapon that Washington has on the outside is Terrell Pryor. He hasn't really played like it too much this year. Cousins and Pryor haven't really gained a whole lot of chemistry yet. That hasn't showed in the stat line anyway. But the best game that Pryor has had so far this season was against the Eagles earlier in the year. He caught 6 passes for 66 yards, which obviously is nothing to write home about, but it is his best effort this year. And so he is going to need to have another great game if Washington is going to be able to upset the Eagles and draw a game closer in the division.
That's exactly the point, is it's a division game, and when you win it, it's like winning a game and a half.
Right.
Because when you ultimately, if you end up in a tiebreaker situation later in the season, having that in your advantage and not having it just be, Philly swept your season series, so that's the end of that. Division games, they are must-wins for teams that think that they're going to be playoff contenders. To flip it to the other side, we've talked about Philadelphia's defense against Washington's offense, so let's flip it to Washington's defense against Philadelphia's offense. It was reported on Wednesday that the Washington first-round pick defensive lineman Jonathan Allen is out for the rest of the season. He suffered a Lisfranc foot injury on the Niners game on Sunday. He was the number 17 overall pick. He was a starter for Washington right away, coming out of Alabama. But to stay on this side of the ball, nobody has said a word yet this season on this podcast about Preston Smith. So I'm going to make Preston Smith our Washington player to watch this week.
Adam has been wanting to talk about Preston Smith for several weeks now.
Just a couple.
And it has been interesting every week to watch Preston Smith just continue to stay in the spotlight.
The third-year pro edge linebacker, edge rusher for Washington, former second-round pick, he started the season with a sack in each of Washington's first four games. And against the Niners last week, he helped on a sack. He was rewarded a half a sack in the stat count. So only 4.5 sacks. A lot of players in the NFL have more. But Preston Smith is one of only 3 players in the entire league to record at least a half a sack in every game he's played in this year. Not counting Myles Garrett, because he's only been for 2. I should clarify, he's only played 2 games for the Browns since starting the year injured. But as far as playing in each of your team's games this year, whether that's 5 or 6, only DeMarcus Lawrence of Dallas, who leads the league with 8.5 total, and Everson Griffin of Minnesota, join Preston Smith on this exclusive list of consistency. Some guys show up and they have a 3-sack game because they're playing against a bad opponent, a bad offensive line, or something like that. A lot of those Jacksonville Jaguars, for instance, week 1, they sacked Houston's quarterbacks between Tom Savage and Deshaun Watson like 9 times, I think. But they have not kept up that pace all year. Preston Smith quietly leads Washington in sacks, more than Ryan Kerrigan, more than any other individual player. Not only that, but according to Pro Football Focus, in terms of qualifying players who play the edge rushing position, an outside linebacker essentially, that they've taken on that new name of edge rusher in recent years, outside linebackers, Smith ranks 16th among all qualifying players in the league in terms of pass coverage. So he's more than just a one-trick pony. He can seal the edge and he can go in coverage, and he's quietly one of Washington's best players this year.
Absolutely an impact player to watch this weekend coming off the edge, and that is our segment on Washington for the week. Now we're going to move on to Baltimore. The Ravens are now 3-3 after losing to my Bears this week.
Your Bears, Chicago.
My Bears, that's exactly right. As I said, they are 3-3, and they're kind of the opposite of Washington, where Washington has had all of their losses come against good teams. The Ravens have had all of their wins come against pretty bad teams. They've beaten Cleveland, Oakland, and Cincinnati. Not exactly a murderer's row of teams, and it seems like it's starting to become a little tense in Owings Mills. The Ravens, over the weekend, John Harbaugh, he had to defend his offensive coordinator, Marty Mornhinweg, and that's never a good sign for a John Harbaugh team. He's already fired his offensive coordinator mid-season twice in his tenure in Baltimore, including last season when he fired former Bears coach Mark Trestman.
Your Bears.
My Bears. And replaced him with Mornenweg. So it's not even a year now that Mornenweg's been on the job, and he's already getting questions about his job security. So not all is well in Baltimore, and they have a game this week coming up against the Vikings, who are another good team. It'll be another tough matchup for them.
Your Vikings? No.
No, those are not my Vikings.
No. But I do love every 4 years, I really need some satisfaction with the purple game. Baltimore and Minnesota are the only two teams that wear purple in the NFL, and it's perfect. It's like the Prince game should be sponsored by Prince's family or something.
They really should let them.
They should have this be the color rush.
They should have let them both play in purple, and everyone can just be like, ah, my eyes.
We were just talking about Chuck Downfield and
Chuck Downfield backyard football.
off the air, and we were... It reminds me of the camouflage power-up in the very first one. For one play, they wear the same exact color as the other team.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I loved backyard football.
It was
the best thing.
But well, that's all we have to say today.
We are off topic, and we apologize, but you know, backyard football is a good time to get off topic, so.
The Ravens, let's just go right to their player to watch for a second, because this is pretty crucial. Brandon Williams returned to practice on Wednesday for the Ravens. He is their defensive tackle, and it's been pointed out, this is not the freshest, newest take in the world, but in case you didn't know, in the first two games of the season, Baltimore... Again, they're playing Cincinnati and Cleveland, not great teams, but they held those teams to an average of 85 yards rushing per game, and Williams was injured in the second game. It was another foot injury, just like actually like Jonathan Allen, not a Liz Frank, but a foot injury. And in the four games that Williams has missed since then, the Ravens are allowing, 169.5 rushing yards per game. They're getting gashed without this guy to plug up the middle. So it's promising if you're a Baltimore fan to hear that Williams is coming back. Possibly. There's no report on his definite status for Sunday's game, but it's good to see that he's back in practice. You know who else is back in practice, Dylan? It's Teddy Bridgewater.
Teddy Bridgewater.
And you got to feel bad for this guy.
I mean, you have to feel bad, but you have to feel great that he is back in practice. When he went down and you saw that injury and you heard the prognosis, he was definitely out for that season, maybe the next one too. You had to think, man, is this guy's career over after only a couple seasons? And it's great to have him back.
It's good for football. He was a first-round pick back a couple years ago. And, yeah, I remember reports of people are crying at the field. Like, players are just, like, emotional about when the injury actually happened. It was the very end of August 2016, ahead of the NFL season last year. So it's been 14 months without Bridgewater going on. Now, he has practiced this week, and Sam Bradford sat out practice on Wednesday, but that does not necessarily mean that Bridgewater is more likely to play than Bradford is in this game against the Ravens. This is because Teddy Bridgewater is still on the pup list, and now that he has returned to practice...
That's the physically unable to perform list.
No, I was talking about Puppy Bowl list.
Well, that too.
I'm thinking that far ahead, because the Jets aren't making the Super Bowl and watch the Puppy Bowl and stuff. Because he's practiced now, the team, the Minnesota Vikings, have 3 weeks, 21 days, to decide whether to activate him or not. If they don't activate him, then he will miss the rest of the season. So he could come back soon. That doesn't at all mean that there's a good chance he'll come back for this game.
Yes, in fact, most reports say that he probably more than likely will not play, but it is heartening to see that he might play in the next couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, St. Bradford's missed the last three games, is that right, Don?
That's right, with a bone bruise in his knee and some wear and tear that he's had from past knee injuries. It's ugly for him as well.
So with everything put together, it might actually just be Case Keenum again going for the Minnesota Vikings. But this Vikings team is 4-2, and they have the tiebreaker over Green Bay now because they beat him last week in a game that Aaron Rodgers, again, injured. A lot of quarterback injuries, a lot of injuries in general in sports these days. That's, I feel like, all we're talking about.
Yeah, it's been especially in the NFL. We already talked about Jonathan Allen. There have been so many season-ending injuries this year.
Another one was Dalvin Cook for this Minnesota Vikings
team.
Exactly.
It's a huge weapon that Baltimore will not have to contend with this week against the Vikings. So Dalvin Cook is out for the season.
A lot of first-round picks, just like Washington's first-round pick, Chargers' first-round pick. I think he might have been come back already, but he got hurt earlier. Mike Williams, the Clemson receiver.
Right, Myles Garrett for the Browns missed a couple games early in the year, and he's finally back. It's been a rough season for NFL injuries. Yeah.
About Cook, though, he's missed a few games now, but while he was playing, he looked really good, and he helped Minnesota assemble a pretty good rushing offense to start the year. Through 6 weeks, they have the 12th best offense in the league, rushing offense, I should say. However, without Cook, that's really led by Jerick McKinnon and a secondary. Part to that is Latavius Murray. It's a very clear 1-2. McKinnon is the starter, more so than it's like a 50-50 split. They throw to McKinnon more often as well. But you know that the Vikings, they're a good team, but they're going to have to beat Baltimore through the air because I don't see if, especially if Brandon Williams does come back for Baltimore, I don't see how Jerick McKinnon's necessarily going to run right through them.
We up to Case Keenum to beat the Ravens essentially on his own now, unless McKinnon or Latavius Murray has a good game. So that's what we'll be watching for this week between the Ravens and the Vikings. And with that, we are going to move on to some Washington Wizards talk.
Yeah.
Right after this, we will get back and talk about the Wizards opening night game when we come back.
Welcome back to War on Hot Takes, presented by Capital News Service. Before I forget, we gotta plug this Twitter account of ours some more. You guys really should follow us, and we really should be using it a little more than we do, but we promise that it's worth your while to just click that follow button, at War on Hot Takes, just how it sounds. CNSMaryland.org is also where you can find us. Dylan and I want to talk about the Wizards now before we wrap this episode up, because they just tipped off their season and did so here in the district, beating the Philadelphia 76ers on Wednesday night, 120-115. John Wall was your leading scorer for Washington with 28 points, and Bradley Beal had 25. Pretty good start for them. It's what you expect. There's a lot of different paths and directions we could take this conversation, Dylan. We only have a few minutes, so where should we begin? John Wall and Bradley Beal, even though they were the top scorers, I want to point out that they didn't shoot particularly well. John Wall took 28 shots, most of anyone on his team. He had 8 assists, but he spent more of the time looking at the bucket, and he only made 10 of his 28 field goal attempts.
It's important to realize that the Wizards didn't shoot well. The bench struggled. They didn't play particularly well overall, and they still won against a young 76ers team. But you're right, in terms of shooting, Wall was 10 for 28, Bradley Beal was 6 for 17, no one shot the three particularly well. We'll get into the only person that did here in a second. But Beal especially was very good at getting into the lane and drawing fouls. He shot 16 free throws, more than anybody else on the team. So that's something that is going to be really important for the Wizards, because they're not a great shooting team. They don't have any shooters like the Warriors who just can make 8 or 9 threes in a game. They're going to need to get in the lane and make free throws.
Well, the Wizards are generally a pretty good shooting team. They wouldn't be one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference if Wall and Beal couldn't go off in any given moment.
Right.
But when you're comparing to the Warriors, right, nobody's as good as the Warriors.
These are guys that make their living in the lane. They have jump shots in order to facilitate drives rather than the other way around, is the way I would characterize
it. Sure, yeah. I think Marcin Gortat gets some credit before we forget to mention him. He had a double-double to open up the year with 16 points and 17 rebounds, 12 of those rebounds on defense. So even though that the Sixers shot a little better percentage-wise as a team, and definitely better from beyond the arc, they couldn't afford to miss the shots that they missed, because usually Gortat was coming down with them.
It's very important, especially for Gortat, because he was going up against Joel Embiid. Embiid, everyone is expecting him to make a huge leap this year. And I mean, he had 18 points and 13 rebounds, but Gortat held him in check for the most part. He didn't let him crash the offensive glass in every play. Yeah. And that's very important, because it limited the Sixers to just one shot.
We have to make sure we drop this, that this segment is sponsored by Small Sample Size Incorporated.
Exactly.
It's one game. We can't project out how the Wizards will do in the next 81 regular season games.
Are you sure? It's not a good time to make wild judgments that we have no idea whether it's going to come true or not?
You can turn on First Take on ESPN if you really want that, sir. Or any of our listeners at home. You might be on the wrong podcast if you haven't figured it out by now, what we're going to not do. What is wrong with the Wizards through one game, Dylan? It's their bench. We got to talk about their bench, because that's something they got to figure out, especially now in light of the injury to Jason Smith last night.
Right. Smith went out. He was the starting power forward. He left the game after 7 minutes. Nominal starting power forward, Marquise Morris. Yeah. He was out.
Listen, yeah, Smith is nominal in name only. He's not your normal starting power forward, but he got the nod from head coach Scott Brooks to fill in, because Marquise Morris is not yet back from his injury that he's dealing with. But then Smith got hurt in the first quarter, so he only ended up playing 7 minutes, and that really extended the floor time for sixth man Kelly Oubre, who's more of a three, more of a small forward. He ended up playing 32 minutes and had a great game off the bench. 14 points on 5 of 10 shooting and 3 of 6 from the three-point line. The only Wizard to make half of his three-point shots, and the only one to make more than one of his three-point shots.
If Oubre is shooting the three well, that really adds dimension to the Wizards team, because he hasn't been known as a three-point shooter throughout his career. Yeah. He's a career 32% shooter from beyond the arc, so that adds another dimension to their game. Not only did he have 14 points, though, he had 8 rebounds, he had 2 assists, 2 blocks, and 2 steals. He really filled up the stat sheet. And if Smith is out and Morris is out for any length of time, that means Oubre is going to move to the 3, and Otto Porter will slot into the 4 spot, taking their place.
That is at least our best guess at it, our speculation, and right, other people's assumption, because this is not a particularly deep team at big man. I don't think that they're going to slot Ian Mahinmi in as the new four with Smith hurt. I don't think that you're going to see a ton of going down the rest of this bench, a lot of them that either didn't play or didn't dress in one case. They don't have a lot of options while Morris is hurt. Now, Jason Smith might not be out very long, but we know that reporters such as myself even asked Coach Scott Brooks at Media Day about the possibility of Otto Porter playing some stretch four. He can fill in that role and stay as a starter instead of being the starting three, and you slot Kelly Oubre in at three. That's a very good starting lineup all of a sudden. Even though it has to be temporary, and even though you could consider it small ball, you don't expect them to win every single one of their games with that lineup. It's temporary.
When they play that type of lineup, it definitely is, as you said, small ball. They're going to get killed on the boards when they play that way, so they can't play it too much, but it is something that they can play a little bit of a faster pace, get out in the open court, and of course that's where Wall and Beal really, really thrive.
Other backups to note, Jody Meeks and Tim Frazier made their regular season debuts for the Washington Wizards, and they did okay. Jody Meeks scored as many points as Kelly Oubre off the bench, 14, and in fewer minutes, too, 14 points in 19 minutes. Meanwhile, Tim Frazier only took one shot, basically the opposite of John Wall, and more of a facilitator, the opposite of the man he was put in here to replace last year, Trey Burke, who is another shooting kind of point guard. So Frazier, even though he didn't score, finished with 5 assists, which was second most on the team, more than any starter besides Wall. But Dylan, just a quick quirk. I like that. To point out before we wrap this up that we notice and we want our listeners to realize the 5 starters, including Jason Smith as a starter, the 5 players who were on the floor when they tipped off before any injuries happened, they finished with all positive plus minuses. Smith's was only plus 4, but the other 4 guys who are your Beals, your Walls, Gortat, and Porter, arguably the 4 best healthy players on the team, they finished all in the teens, essentially. Well, Beal was 12. I guess that doesn't count as a teen.
Close enough.
It's that decade. That decade. Plus 12, plus 19, plus 16, plus 14. And do we need to explain our listeners what plus minus is? I hope not.
No, essentially plus minus is just for those of you who don't know that how many points they outscored the other team or were outscored by when they were on the floor.
So your 5 bench players. So the Wizards only had 10 players enter this game. And the 5 bench players who did play, Mahinmi, Frazier, Meeks, Oubre, and Scott, all negative. Especially Frazier minus 12. I don't know what happened there, but the Sixers had a very big second quarter, 36 points to 24. They outscored the Wizards in that quarter to get right back in the game and make it really close at halftime. So anyway, again, small sample size incorporated. Right. We can't say that, here are going to be the Wizards' problem for the next 81 games, right. But it goes to show you that this bench is everyone expecting to be the worst part of the team.
It is the X factor. Exactly. I mean, it's going to be the biggest impediment to their success. If the bench is not playing well, the Wizards will not achieve all they want to achieve this season. But if it does, they can be a really dangerous team in the East.
Definitely. And when you're outshot by your opponent and you still squeak out a win against a decent team like Philadelphia is expected to be, that's a good sign going forward. Winning the close games. I mean, we've talked about how that can be luck, but in basketball, it's a little more than luck. It's a lot about strategy and calling the timeouts at the right times and making the right clutch plays.
And having someone at the end like a John Wall or a Bradley Beal that can go get you a bucket when you really need it. So basketball is less susceptible to those close games or mostly luck tropes as we see in other sports. There really is a whole lot more strategy in the final minutes of basketball.
Here's something we didn't mention. Markel Fultz made his NBA debut as well as Ben Simmons, because Ben Simmons didn't play any last year in his supposed rookie year. Back-to-back first overall picks in the last 2 years. But Fultz, he's a DeMatha guy. He's from around this area here in PG County, Maryland. He had 10 points off the bench. He was not asked to start. But every Sixers starter also had double digits, and led by Robert Covington with 29 in 29 minutes. So looking forward, the Wizards play a second home game Friday night against the Detroit Pistons, and then they take their first road trip and their first West Coast trip of the year pretty quick. That will start in Denver, then play at the Los Angeles Lakers, and then the Golden State Warriors, the defending champions, before finishing in a slightly less intimidating city called Sacramento. They'll be back home November 1st after that trip to play another West Coast team named Phoenix, but that one you'll be able to go to at the Capital One Arena, the newly named, renamed, no longer Verizon Center, Capital One Arena. This has been fun. Dylan, I think we really went long this time.
We did. We had a lot to talk about. It was a busy week in the Washington-Baltimore sports scene.
And it could be a very busy week next week, and we want you to keep on our Twitter. Like I plugged it before, it's @WarOnHotTakes. stay tuned to that, because we may be having a really nice surprise announcement coming up.
This is very important. There's a possibility we have a special guest next week. We will keep you informed, so keep checking that Twitter account.
Yep. There's nothing at all set in stone yet, but it could be pretty fantastic what we've got set up for you next week. Besides whoever guest we may have, you know we'll be talking NFL. We'll be reviewing what happened to Washington on that Monday night game. We'll be reviewing your up and down, left and right Baltimore Ravens. And baseball's probably over now, isn't it?
Baseball is probably over. It's very sad. No more organ music.
No more organ music. We're gonna pop it in right now in the editing process and just give it its last moment, because we really are fans of our own drops here.
Just a little bit of nostalgia for you guys.
Okay, we're going to stop talking. Thanks very much for joining us. For Dylan Sin, I'm Adam Zlalka. This has been War on Hot Takes.